Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back today to talk about getting in a box once again. This is going to be the sequel to an episode that aired on Tuesday of this week. That previous one, we talked about cats getting in boxes, cats being unable to resist the lure of a cardboard cube. And we discussed some biological facts about cats that could potentially drive the box-seeking behavior, including natural behavioral preferences for hiding places, especially under stressful conditions. We talked about some studies about that, but then also things that I hadn't thought about as much before, like thermoregulation, which seems to me to be potentially a big part of the explanation of why cats would seek, especially some kinds of boxes, the kinds that don't really afford anything like a hiding place. But we also talked about the more difficult to explain phenomenon of cats sitting on and in flat squares on the floor, as well as studies into cats and visual illusions. Today, we wanted to come back and look at the human side of this, humans desiring to get into the box or get into the square.
Yeah, because your mind can't help but go in this direction. Because, I mean, on one level, the same cardboard boxes that end up attracting the cat in a household, it'll attract children for sure. I mean, If you've been around children or ever been a child, you know the appeal of a box, a big cardboard box. There's so many things you can do with it. Cut some holes in it, some windows, some doors. You've got yourself, potentially a whole afternoon of entertainment there.
Were you a fort builder as a child? I definitely was.
I think so, but I don't remember having as... I feel like they're far... You know, we live in an age now where cardboard boxes are just such a regular part of our life. And as a kid, I don't remember having as much access to cool giant cardboard boxes.
I just mean in general. I mean, building small enclosures out of anything you could get, not just boxes, because we
couch
would build
cushions
them.
Especially,
couch cushions, of course, a perfect building material for indoor forts. But also, I recall with a friend of mine, we spent one summer at least building a fort out of sticks in the woods, just sort of like, you know, leaning them together to create a very rough sort of hut. I don't think it would have been functional as a living space because the roof would have leaked if it rained or anything like that. But it was still, it felt very cool to have built something that you could get inside.
Yeah. And so there's definitely the whole, you know, childhood dimension to it. And I guess we'll continue to touch a bit on that. But also, I think as adults, we can look to boxes and box-like environment. And it's interesting to sort of engage with the degree to which we are drawn to these spaces or repulsed by these spaces. And sometimes it's hard to figure out exactly how we feel about them. So we should go ahead and state the obvious, and that is that we know on one level that that small confined spaces can be extremely detrimental to human well-being. Solitary confinement is a cruel and debilitating treatment. It's associated with a whole host of negative mental states.
Yes, clearly that's true. And another thing along the same lines is when I was trying to find good sources for today's episode, for every, you know, one source you could find that has anything to do with a desire for small spaces, there are going to be 100 about the hatred of small spaces, about claustrophobia, right, and related, you know, mind states. Like, obviously, being in a tight confined space when you don't want to be there or against your will is a major preoccupation of humans. And it's really easy to get obsessed with this idea and really hate it.
Yeah, yeah. Though, at least for some, at least for a segment of the population, confined spaces of choice can certainly be comforting, at least in moderation. And also, I should say, sometimes it might be more of a desire for the confined space than a reality of the confined space. And I'll get a little bit more into what I mean by that in just a bit. But, you know, it should be noted that human beings might not all think of box living as the ideal way to go. But we do spend a lot of time living in boxes in the modern world. I mean, there's a high chance you're in a box space right now. Or if you were outside, perhaps you can see various box spaces from where you are. I mean, we are creatures of the box.
Oh, you mean not just our houses, but also, say, our cars, but also boxes within the boxes. So within a house or within an office building where you work, you might have a little office or a little corner that's sort of made into a partially enclosed thing, or a cubicle if you're lucky at work.
Yeah, but I mean, but even just talking about our houses and our rooms, and I mean, I have to admit, like right now, I am in a small closet. I'm in a confined space that, for the most part, feels pretty comfortable. I'm pretty happy in this little confined space. I have my computer here. I have my mic. There's a bookshelf here that has some books, some games. There's some miniatures on it. All the coats in the house are helping to pad out the sound. Uh-huh. So you know, I definitely feel a certain attraction to a cozy confined space like this.
It's probably for me conditioning, because I'm used to recording in a studio that's sort of a dark padded area when we were recording in the office. But even recording from home, I'm also in a box. I am in the corner of a room, sort of walled off by an acoustic partition wall that essentially creates a sort of shadowy corner where I can explore all the depraved thoughts that that will eventually become part of this podcast.
Now, we recently discussed Diogenes in our episode on beans, the 5th century BCE Cynic philosopher who is said to have lived in a tub or a large jar in the streets. And after we mentioned it, I had to look up some interpretations of what this might have looked like. You know, sometimes it is like it looks like a big stone barrel that he's living in.
Yeah, I think it was said to be maybe in the marketplace of Athens.
Yeah, so right out in the middle of everything. And ultimately, you know, even a tub, large jar, not that different from a box. And I should point out that there is a disorder that is known as Diogenes syndrome. Though it's not tied to the idea of living in confined spaces, it's actually something of a misnomer, as it's characterized, the syndrome is characterized by self-neglect, squalor, hoarding, and social withdrawal. Diogenes, however, was a minimalist, and you don't see stories about him hoarding anything. That would run against the whole idea, nor was he socially withdrawn.
No. I mean, you could consider Diogenes withdrawn in the sense that he made a point out of rejecting social convention. So he was sort of withdrawn from the social contract in a way, withdrawn from a buy-in with the rest of society and from expectations and norms. But he was not withdrawn in terms of his interactions with other people. He was very public and confrontational about being not a part of your system, man.
Now, you might well wonder, well, if there is a psychological disorder associated with the desire to live inside a tub or a jar or a box, you know, what would we call it? Perhaps not claustrophobia, but claustrophilia. And yes, there is such a classification, abnormal pleasure derived from being in a confined space.
I was looking this up, and at least I found, I don't know if you came across the same thing, that most of the sources using this term were using it with a kind of sexual connotation, that it was like a particular sexual obsession or fetish for being in confined spaces.
I ran across a little of that. I mean, for the most part, you don't see it discussed near as as claustrophobia.
Yeah.
And I guess the thing is, claustrophobia is something that can kick in and be a detriment to your ability to live your life. You know, it could prevent you from, say, boarding a crowded train that you need to board, that sort of thing. Whereas claustrophilia, I mean, I guess it could get you into some trouble, but yeah, you just don't see as much literature about it. You do see some stuff that seems to be going in a more erotic direction. But even some of that, I feel like it's getting into an area where you're not necessarily talking about like pure titillation. You're ultimately getting at this idea of enclosure and the comforting aspect of enclosure, even if it is discussed in an area that is like, closer to more, erotic considerations. But for instance, there was one paper that I found, a Romanian paper recently published titled, What If I Didn't Go Out Anymore? Mm-hmm. Which I think is a great, great title, by Rosella Valdry. And I wasn't able to get access to the full paper. So I'll just read the abstract here, which I think gets to the heart of what the author is discussing. Quote, one of the psychological reactions to the COVID-19 lockdowns is psychic withdrawal, claustrophilia. The author asks why this paradoxical reaction occurs, naming the death drive and fear of freedom.
Now, you can probably hear from some of the keywords at the end of this that this paper I looked at, this is actually published in a journal for psychoanalysis, which means we're in Freudian or Freudian adjacent territory. So I guess we don't know what empirical or modern scientific validity of the explanation given in this paper would be. But I think the phenomenon it identifies is something I've seen expressed a good bit, actually, that there is a certain personality type and a certain way that some people have adapted to the COVID-19 lockdowns that says, I don't know. I don't know if I really need to leave my house anymore. There are certain aspects of ongoing quarantine that are kind of appealing. Now, obviously, that's not going to be true of everybody. I personally, ever since the 2-week mark after my second vaccination, I have been thrilled at the prospect of getting out of the house more often, and especially being able to be around other people more often. That's been really exciting to me, even though I think I'm overall a pretty introverted person. Like, I like being by myself. I like being at home. It's just there's sort of pent-up demand that has built in my brain over the past year. But that's not there for everybody. Some people are like, yeah, I kind of like how things are for me.
Yeah, and I guess you also have to realize you can divide it up in different ways. Like, there are people that are, I'm sure, all about like getting back out there socially, seeing friends and family, but might be more of this school when it comes to work and say, actually, why should I ever leave my house to work? Like, why do I need to be in an office? Like, it probably already is interesting in a lot of places where they're having to re-examine the purpose of the physical shared workspace, mm-hmm. and then potentially have to make a case for it to to their employees or whoever. Whereas before it was just kind of a given. Well, of course we all come and we share a single space to work. But now they're potentially having to go out there and say, "Hey, everybody, why don't we come back together and work in one big space again and share a coffee maker?"
Ding, ding, ding. You have got my number here. I've been really excited ever since getting vaccinated to see friends more often. I have no desire to go back to a shared workspace, except that it's not that I don't like seeing my coworkers. I very much do. I would like to see all of our coworkers again socially. I just don't want to have to work around other people. I'm so much more productive at home by myself where I can focus and not be distracted by a workplace.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think it's going to break down differently for different people. But of course, as sort of an introvert myself, I can also get a sense of this too, where there's a lot of movement to open back up and, you know, and get back out there. And after over a year of doing the opposite, you know, it can feel a little much. It can feel a little threatening, the idea of going, you know, from 0 to 50 in too short of a time. And I think I've seen some authors online talking about the idea of, you know, the importance even of finding like middle ground things you can do to sort of work back up to things like this. So, instead of like your first thing back out in the world shouldn't be, going to 70 miles per hour. It should maybe, go to 25 miles per hour. See what that feels like.
Maybe start with a small get together with other vaccinated friends instead of the monster truck show.
Yeah. Don't immediately go to the monster truck show or the mega concert or whatever it happens to be. But back just to the idea of small, tight, enclosed spaces, comfy places being appealing. Even though there are negative aspects again to such spaces. I have to admit to having felt this kind of draw to such spaces throughout my life. And sometimes it is an actual space that I'm inhabiting, like, the closet here for the podcasting. Other times I do think it gets more into not the reality of the enclosed space, but just the idea of the enclosed space, the vision, the mental image of the enclosed space or a physical representation of something that looks like a comfy enclosed environment.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder about the extent to which some of the appeal of tight enclosed spaces is at the conceptual level. It's not even necessarily like a physical sensory thing, but something about the idea of being in a small space.
Yeah. So when I was a kid, I remember I would have I had this dream, and either I don't know if it was a recurring dream or just a very vivid dream that I had once that I've just always remembered. But it was in my house at the time, and I found a sort of tunnel underneath the stairs, and it was painted and carpeted with wall-to-wall carpeting, the same as the rest of the home. And the tunnel extended maybe 8 feet back, then made a sharp turn left. And it was a well-lit environment in the dream, despite there not being any presence of lights that I remember. But if you followed this little tunnel back, then you took that turn, it would go for a little bit, and then it would have another turn. And it would so there would be like a kind of a spiraling around, and then it would terminate in a cubicle space that was just large enough for me to ball up comfortably. But either in this dream or in subsequent dreams, my body grew to where I could no longer comfortably venture into the heart of this place. And then I ultimately couldn't reach the heart of it at all.
Wow.
So, without going crazy with dream interpretation, because I don't know, I'm kind of increasingly of the night blender school of dreams where none of it means anything. But there are obvious parallels to make between this idea and anxieties of, say, leaving childhood, of growing up, even a desire to return to the womb, if you want to get real Freudian about it. Because, of course, this is central to the Freudian dual concepts of Eros and Thanatos. Thanatos, the god of death, personification of the death drive, and Eros, the god of love. And this is linked to a desire to return to the safety of the womb.
Without buying into the explanatory validity of Freudian concepts, I do think that there's something interesting about the idea of the death drive as it relates to, I don't know, a sort of desire for the mortification of the flesh that I want to link up to a historical example I have in just a minute.
Yeah, and of course, often, Freudian thought takes a decidedly sexual tone in its explorations, but even in a non-sexual way, I feel like this idea of returning to the womb, I feel like it holds a certain amount of truthiness to it. It actually reminds me of a wonderful short bit in a recent episode of the John Oliver show, where he talked about his desire to be an egg. I think the basic setup was like, this is the kind of thing you don't actually share with your partner, your desire to be an egg. And he goes on this extended little monologue about the desire to be an egg and like the comforting, how comfortable it would be to not only like to be inside the egg, but to be the egg, to be the goo within the protective outer shell of the egg.
Yeah, beautifully expressed, actually, to be in there alone with the goop, just you and the goop, and knowing that whoever is around you, outside you, has to handle you very carefully.
Yeah. And so I feel like it got to the heart of this sort of often kind of abstract or subconscious thing I feel when I'm, especially if I'm looking at pictures of something or encountering a setting in a motion picture or a TV show. So especially tidy and cozy ship or train cabins. For instance, I really enjoyed the first two seasons of the Snowpiercer TV show. And I think part of it is the way they depict some of the tight living spaces. I'm like, oh, I can imagine being in there. I can imagine curling up in that bed that's set into the wall.
I haven't seen the show. I did see the movie Snowpiercer, and I liked the movie, but there was absolutely nothing about it that was appealing whatsoever to me. Well, that might be a difference in how the show is, the sets are done.
Well, I think the main difference is, of course, the movie, which is also really good. Mm-hmm. The movie only has so much time, and they've got to get to that bloody revolution.
Right.
Whereas the TV show just has more time to deal with, more space to lay out the world of the show and the world of the train. And therefore, you get those moments where you're like, oh, I can imagine being in there. Nobody's mm-hmm. dying in here right now. It seems fine.
Now, apart from the post-apocalyptic setting, in general, I just do really love the idea of a little train compartment, a little private compartment in a train. It's just lovely.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, another area, and this again goes to sci-fi, is when you encounter a good suspended animation chamber in science fiction, like the stasis pods in Alien. Even I find, for me anyway, even when they give those pods kind of a darker tone, you know, like you're throwing up when you get out of it, or you're weak when you get out of it, or you're, you know, they're really leaning into the sort of glass casket, Grimm's fairy tale, you know, version of it. I often find them kind of relaxing to think about, maybe not at a, you know, an actual conscious level where I'm like, oh man, I wish I was in there and Michael Fassbender was threatening me with experiments in my dreams, but more like there's just something in me where I'm like, that looks comfy and safe and nice.
I just want to be the mummy of Vladimir Lenin.
Yeah, it's that sort of thing. And again, it's like if I stop and I apply rational thought to it, it maybe doesn't sound so great, mm-hmm. You know, or even just apply it to the plot of the thing that it is embedded within. But on some level, it seems nice. And I feel like this even applies to really nice coffins and caskets. I don't know if you've had this experience as well, but if I'm like checking out, or it's not like if I'm at an actual funeral, but if I'm just thinking about caskets or caskets show up in a film, I'll sometimes look at them and be like, yeah, that looks pretty comfy. There's something attractive about that. And I realize part of it is that, yeah, that's kind of the whole game of casket making and casket salesmanship, because
they're
it doesn't
for the
matter.
Living. Yeah.
Yeah. They're for the living. The living have to look at that and think, I think I'd be comfortable in there. So my you know, deceased loved one, they will be comfortable in there, even though, of course, they're dead. It doesn't matter to them where they are.
Mm-hmm. It makes me think of the scene in Ed Wood where Bela Lugosi is coffin shopping and he's trying out laying in all the coffins. And, I can't even fold my arms.
Yeah. I think it is also compounded by the fact that even though I have never actually tried out a coffin, you see this in films all the time where someone is like that, you know, trying out a coffin, or they're hiding in a coffin to get away from bad guys, or maybe they've even been buried alive. But live people find themselves in coffins all the time in cinema. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, as much as the appeal of a small, tight, cozy space like a box or a coffin might be rooted in some kind of a conceptual abstraction, you know, pictures you're putting together in your head about what would be conceptually comforting as a space to occupy, I think there could also be some raw physical biological reality to this, because in the last episode we talked about research by Dodman and Grandin about the stress relieving potential of flank pressure on the bodies of mammals. The research we were looking at was from the 1980s, and it specifically was focused on pigs, but it seems there is probably a broader mammalian response to having a gentle squeezing pressure on the side of the body that triggers a sort of stress relief response within the neuroendocrine system.
Yeah, I think the one most famous example of this, and I think we briefly mentioned her in the last one. I think she was an author on one of the papers you cited.
Yeah, that's what I was just talking about.
Yeah. This would, of course, be the hug machine invented by Temple Grandin as a therapeutic stress-relieving device to resolve anxiety and sensory issues.
And Temple Grandin, if you're not familiar, she's an animal behaviorist, but has also written a lot and done stuff about the autism spectrum. She herself is autistic.
Yeah, I think they made a movie several years back, and I think Claire Danes played her, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In the film. I remember it being a fun film. I usually don't watch a lot of biopics, but I thought it was pretty good. Hmm. So she invented it while attending college and was inspired by the squeeze chutes used for cattle inoculation. So cattle walks in, the walls, these kind of like, you know, these walls move in, kind of apply pressure from either side, and then you're able to inject the cattle, the cow with the inoculation. And so she found it very useful, at least for a long stretch in her life. And then subsequent studies have found that deep pressure may have a calming effect, especially on persons with autism, especially if those persons have high anxiety levels.
This is actually described in a paper that Temple Grandin published in 1992 in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology, and the paper was called Calming Effects of Deep Touch Pressure in Patients with Autistic Disorder, College Students, and Animals. And so just to read from Grandin's abstract here, quote, "Many people with autistic disorder have problems with oversensitivity to both touch and sound. The author, an autistic person, developed a device that delivers deep touch pressure to help her learn to tolerate touching and to reduce anxiety and nervousness. The squeeze machine applies lateral, inwardly directed pressure to both lateral aspects of a person's entire body by compressing the user between two foam-padded panels. Clinical observations and several studies suggest that deep touch pressure is therapeutically beneficial for both children with autistic disorder and probably children with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Only minor and occasional adverse effects have been noted." But then also Grandin notes that there are data to show that this is not only effective at calming people who have autism, but also at what is called non-referred college students. I think just the general population, mm-hmm. and also points to studies, I think, similar to and probably including the one we mentioned last time in animal welfare. And so that there could be some significant clinical value to some kind of squeeze machine that provides this deep sort of hug-like pressure with these foam pads almost swaddling the body.
Yeah, yeah. And to come back to what I said earlier about like some of the sort of the erotic treatments of claustrophilia, I think some of that, my sort of gut intuition here is that like some of that is ultimately getting back to this idea, you know, like the idea that if I somehow closely confine my body, if I like, you know, vacuum seal myself between two pieces of vinyl or latex or something, that like ultimately you're getting at the comforting reality of the that similar to something that you might find in the hug machine, as opposed to something that's just pure titillation. But I could be wrong on that. And of course, obviously, it's going to vary from person to person. Nobody's going to have exactly the same reaction to the sort of stimuli we're describing here.
Well, I guess one thing this highlights is that it's not always totally easy to make a clear dividing line between what is erotic pleasure and what is other types of pleasure.
Yeah. Now, another thing that you see marketed in similar ways to the hug machine is, of course, a weighted blanket, and I believe they even use these for dogs sometimes, but humans especially, a weighted blanket can be comforting, even like a nice sleeping bag. I don't know, these sort of sarcophagus style sleeping bags. I've always found certainly the idea of them comforting, but even on a camping trip, like being all zipped up and kind of mummified in one of those can feel pretty nice. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention isolation tanks or, you know, flotation tanks in all of this, because that's as close to what John Oliver was talking about with the dream of being an egg as possible. Like, you really do become the goop. You become the salty goop in there. The salty goop is, you know, generally at the same temperature as your body, and you're cut off from the rest of reality, and you're left with the inner reality of yourself.
If only you could take a nice, tasty yolk in there with you and then just hang out for weeks.
I think that's one of the appeals of some of the sort of stasis chamber sci-fi that you get, is that mm-hmm. sometimes you are in a goop in there, right?
Oh,
and you're
yeah.
like, oh, man, look at the goop just looks so nice and warm and comforting.
Like when Neo wakes up in the Matrix, I remember.
Yeah.
So that scene's supposed to be liberating, but I remember, you know, when he's pulling all the plugs out and he's got the goop all over him and everything. I always remember thinking in that scene, like, oh, that looks like the worst, like, wake up early in the morning scene ever. Just don't you want to get back in that cozy goop bed?
yeah. Ultimately, I guess the character Cypher, he had it figured out. He's like, get me back in that goop. What do mm-hmm. I have to do? Can you get me back in that goop today?
I'll betray any friends. I don't care. I just got to get back in the egg.
Absolutely.
Anyway, this subject of desiring to be squeezed into a small space or in a box of some kind, it got me thinking about a subject that I've actually long found fascinating and thought about, especially over the last year. And that is the subject of people who were known as anchorites. These were people who in the medieval period would willingly enclose themselves permanently inside a tiny cell where they would usually spend the rest of their lives confined, devoting their days to prayer and meditation, sometimes interacting with visitors and passing food and waste only through small holes in the walls. There's actually a great article from 2018 from the British Library about the Anchoritic tradition. It's by a scholar named Dr. Mary Wellesley, who's a British Library affiliate, and it's called The Life of an Anchoress. An anchoress is a term used for a female anchorite. And also, I just want to give a shout out in general to the British Library and their various blogs and stuff, because they consistently put out a lot of fantastic content that features primary source materials front and center and quotes extensively from the primary sources. Mm-hmm. I love that they do that. That's a great site. But anyway, so back to Wellesley's article here. So the word anchorite and the word anchoress, these are from the Greek anachorio, which means to withdraw. So the cell in which an anchorite lived was known as their anchor hold. And so if you want to picture one of these places, you have to imagine a sort of tiny, maybe closet-sized stone house that's attached to the outside wall of a church. Wellesley estimates that the average anchor hold was probably no bigger than about 12 feet square. Some of them might have had two small rooms, but it seems most were just one tiny cell, one little room. And again, this cell would have had no door, so an anchorite or anchoress would have to have a support system in order to survive. And for this reason, it seems this was a pathway that was mostly reserved for wealthy people who could afford to pay one or two servants to spend basically the rest of their lives looking after them. So they would have to have a servant to bring them meals, to take away waste and garbage, etc. And so this exchange of materials would usually happen through one of three openings in the walls of the anchor hold. The most common design for an anchor hold seems to have been, it would be a cell built into the side of a church building, and it would have one window that opens into a kind of parlor, a tiny adjoining room where material could be passed back and forth to the servant. So you could take away waste, you could bring them meals. And then there would be a second small window known as a squint, which would open into the church itself, and this would be so that the anchorite or anchoress could watch mass and receive communion from inside the church. And then there would be a third small window that would open to the outside world, and it was through this window that the occupant could receive visitors. Now, you might think that being walled up permanently inside a tiny cell for the rest of your life sounds pretty awful, and it certainly would be if it were against your will. But it seems that the anchoritic life was actually quite desirable to lots of people in the late Middle Ages, at least to people who could afford it. Wellesley notes some figures that there were at least 100 known anchorites and anchoresses in England in the 12th century, and then 200 more from the 13th to the 15th centuries. She also notes an interesting gender divide, that women outnumbered men consistently among the anchoritic lifestyle. And in the 14th and 15th century, there were twice as many anchoresses as there were male anchorites. And in the 13th century, there were about three times as many. And we'll come back to some possible reasons offered for the popularity of anchoritic life and the special popularity among women in a bit. But first, I wanted to bring up how there's another thing that's interesting to me about the way that medieval sources talk about anchorites and anchoresses, that they are sometimes spoken of as if they were already dead, even while they're alive. So I wanted to set the scene by reading a passage from Wellesley's article. Quote, "At the moment of an anchoress's enclosure, a priest would recite the office of the dead, which was the set of prayers said at a person's funeral. This symbolized that the recluse was dead to the world. In fact, it seems that some recluses did not leave their cells even after they died. Archaeological excavations of some anchor holds have revealed the remains of people who presumably once lived there. In St. Anne's Church in Lewes, Sussex, the anchoress's grave has been positioned in exactly the place where she would have knelt daily to view the mass through the squint." So you live in the anchor hold, you do mass through this tiny slot in the wall, and then you get buried peering through the slot.
Wow, it's this is one that is, you run into plenty of things in the historical record that are challenging for the modern, for many modern humans to understand. But this one's tough, because on one hand, it sounds like it's easier to just say, oh, well, these were clearly zombies. They were zombies, mm-hmm. and you cared about them, so you just kind of locked them in a hole next to the church. And And then you realize, of course, that's fantasy. So you try and sort of try to find parallels in the modern world, and like it's crazy to imagine this like at a modern Christian church that mm-hmm. somebody could be a wealthy church member could just say, hey, can I just live in the wall over here, and then watch church all the time, and I'm just here, and I'll just never leave, and then you can just bury me in there. Like, I guess the closest thing I can imagine is if you had like a really big sports fan, and they had, what do they call those, like the special rooms that you watch from?
Like the skybox?
Yeah, like what if you had your own skybox?
Order up your wings, yeah.
It was just for you, just large enough for you to sit and eat wings and watch your football game. But you're just like, I'm never going to leave. I'm just going to stay there all the time. I'll watch all the football games. And when I die, you can just seal me up in there.
I love church that much.
Yeah. But of course, even that does not feel like an accurate description of what's happening here.
No, I think there's something. So I think there's some stuff we'll get to in a minute that might help explain the psychology of this a little more. I mean, also, you can't, though it's kind of hard to understand, even from a modern religious perspective, even if you're a religious person today, usually your religious devotion wouldn't seem to take this form, right? You know, this level of like a total body sacrifice to your religious practice.
Well, like I think a lot of us can understand, say, the desire or sort of the ideal of, say, a monastic life. Mm-hmm. You know, I find myself, and maybe this is from, you know, just being a fan of like the Name of the Rose and all, mm-hmm. where like occasionally I'll be like, man, with like, you know, background thought that's not really tied to a lot of practical thinking, where it's kind of like, what if I was just a monk instead?
Right.
Like this is sort of idea and roughly in your head that would be easier. I would just live in a little space and I would have my duties. And, you know, mm-hmm. Again, it's just like this sort of empty fantasy in the back of your head that doesn't actually match up with the reality of monastic life or what you actually want out of life. But it's mm-hmm. kind of in the background there enough to where I can be like, well, I understand the desire for some of that. But not the living inside of a tomb.
It's not a desire you have fully formed, but you can kind of feel pulses of it every now and then.
Yeah, exactly.
I know that feeling. Anyway, so to go on with Wellesley's article here, more about the life of anchoresses in particular, she cites a 13th century how-to guide for people who wish to become anchoresses. And this is called the, and again, I'm not quite sure how to pronounce this, but I think it is the Ancren Wisa, which is spelled A-N-C-R-E-N-E, and then the second word is W-I-S-S-E, the Ancren Wisa, I'll say. So the Ancren Wisa says, admiring their own white hands is bad for many anchoresses who keep them too beautiful, such as those who have too little to do. They should scrape up the earth every day from the grave in which they will rot.
Yikes.
Wow. So like if your hands are too clean, that's you're being idle too much. So you need to supplement your prayer and contemplation with scraping up the dirt. And I guess that further shows your devotion to God, but it reflects one of the major characteristics of the life of an anchoress, which is asceticism, the denial of worldly pleasures in favor of the pure life of contemplating and praying to God. And this was a common way of viewing holiness in medieval Europe, that the body is corrupt and sinful, and that the fleshly desires of the body must be denied in favor of the pure edification of the spirit. And so, of course, you could see this in all kinds of ways that medieval monks might sort of punish themselves or deny their own bodily desires. But the Ancren Wisa makes it clear that you shouldn't go overboard with asceticism. And Wellesley pulls a great quote here. So this is from the source. It says, "No one should gird herself with any kind of belt except for her confessor's permission, or wear any iron or hair or hedgehog skins, or beat herself with these, or with a lead whip, or make herself bloody with holly or brambles."
So the idea being deny the flesh, but don't punish the flesh.
Right. That seems maybe if you're punishing the flesh that much, I wonder if there was a kind of a suspicion that like you're getting pleasure from going overboard to that extent. Like you're going too far and perhaps there's like a horseshoe theory of pleasure and pain here. Like you go too far into pain and you're actually maybe getting a kick out of it.
Well, it reminds me of again, the idea of the isolation tank in the modern setting. Mm-hmm. Like the idea is that you don't pay as much attention to your body. in order to contemplate other things.
Yeah.
And I feel like something similar is going on in these cells here. But again, if the whole idea is to focus on God and not the body, then yeah, you shouldn't. I can see the argument for not finally manicuring your hands, but also not spending too much time punishing your hands either.
Now, another interesting thing that Wellesley gets into in this article is she quotes from a primary text from the Middle Ages called, I think it's called just Book, but it is by an author named Marjorie Kemp. And Wellesley mentions that this is one of the earliest known, or maybe the earliest known autobiographical book written in English. And Kemp visits a famous anchoress in this book known as Julian of Norwich. And the meeting is described as follows in Kemp's book. Quote, "Then she was charged by our Lord to go to an anchoress in the same city, who was called Dame Julian. And so she did, and she showed her the grace that God had put in her soul, and many full speeches and conversations that our Lord spoke to her soul, and many wonderful revelations which she revealed to the anchoress in order to establish if there was any deception in them, for the anchoress was an expert in such things and could give good counsel on the matter." And Wellesley notes that this account by Kemp is interesting for several reasons. First of all, it's a picture of female friendship written by a woman, something that is not very common in the texts that survive to us today from the Middle Ages. But also she notes that it shows a woman in a position of spiritual authority. Julian of Norwich here is being sought for religious counsel at a time when the church itself was controlled entirely by men. And Wellesley claims that the reason Julian could be sought out so readily for spiritual advice, even though she was not part of the male authority structure of the church, was that she was an anchoress. And this raises an interesting contradiction. Despite the fact that anchoresses were walled up and unable to leave their cell for the rest of their lives, they were nevertheless very much an important part of the civic and ecclesiastical community, maybe more so than they would be if they were free to walk the streets.
This is interesting, and it makes me wonder, this might be a stretch, but maybe not so much given many of the things that are referenced by the author, but in Red Dragon and in The Silence of the Lambs, we have two characters go to visit Hannibal Lecter, not in an interview room, as seems to be typical of with incarcerated individuals, both in reality and in other fictional treatments, but they go visit him at his cell, at his enclosure. And he's presented, of course, on one hand level, this is a monster in his lair. But on the other hand, he is a wise individual who is segmented apart from society and is sought out for their wisdom and insight.
That's really good comparison. I hadn't thought about that, but I wonder if the anchoritic tradition was somewhat in Thomas Harris's head here.
Might have been. I mean, Harris made allusions to a lot of to a number of historical elements, and I think even elements from Christian history. So perhaps.
Well, I want to think more about this role of the anchorite or the anchoress in the community and their role as a source of spiritual authority. So the guidebooks for anchoresses at the time advised them to be careful not to spend too much time socializing through the window to the outside world. For example, this is again from the Ancrene Wyse. It says that you shouldn't take meals with visitors. Quote, "This is showing too much friendliness because it goes against the nature of any form of religious life, and most of all that an anchoress who is utterly dead to the world. One has often heard of the dead speaking with the living, but I have never found yet that they ate with the living." So this is really interesting. It's like it contains this contradiction. On one hand, the anchorite or the anchoress is dead to the world. She is of no value to the world. She's basically not a living human being anymore. And yet she is a source of spiritual authority and insight, much in the same way that a message from beyond the grave, maybe to a person who's already gone to heaven, would be.
Yeah. Like they're almost they're half dead, that they already have a foot in the world beyond.
Yeah. And so despite these warnings of like, you know, you shouldn't eat if you're an anchoress, you shouldn't eat with visitors. That's just too friendly. It's clear that a good amount of interaction did take place through that window to the outside world. And in a way, the anchoress could become a sort of hub for the communities, both spiritually and socially. And so I want to read another section from the Ancrene Wyse that is cited by Wellesley. Quote, "The anchoress is called an anchor, and anchored under the church like an anchor under the side of a ship, to hold the ship, so that waves and storms do not capsize it. Just so, all holy church, which is described as a ship, should anchor on the anchoress, for her to hold it so that the devil's blasts, which are temptations, do not blow it over."
That's interesting. So it's the idea that the anchoress is providing like a stabilizing element to the church or to the local faithful, to the physical being, the spiritual being of the church itself.
Yeah. And so I think given some of these considerations, maybe it is less surprising how popular the anchoritic way of life was, right? That it, despite being sort of dead to the world, you would also in a weird way be held up as a special source of wisdom or insight, and you might have an important symbolic role in as a kind of like protector of the church and the church community and somebody that people would seek out for advice. And it also seems that, like, according to what Wellesley says here, that this was a way for women to have spiritual authority within the church that they wouldn't be able to have because, like, by say entering the clergy, which they couldn't do. Mm-hmm. Now, I was wondering what we have in the way of anchoresses describing their own feelings about their lifestyle in their own words, and there's actually very little of that. So to read a section from Wellesley on that, quote, "The only text written by an anchoress to survive the period is Julian of Norwich's Revelations. All of the other texts about anchoritism were written by people advising those who had chosen or wished to choose the anchoritic way of life. In Julian's text, she gives away very little about her experience of being enclosed. At one point she writes, quote, 'This place is prison, this life is penance.' But we cannot be sure whether Julian was referring to her earthly life more broadly or the specific circumstances of her cell." And I found that passage really interesting too, because I wonder if the physical enclosure of the anchoritic way of life takes on a special appeal if you already, in a way, view fleshly, earthly life as itself a kind of prison or enclosure.
Yeah. You sort of like an immediate physical recreation of what you believe reality to be.
So anyway, that's all bouncing around in my head about the possible psychology that would lead someone to want to become an anchoress. But also, I just had to mention a couple of other details that I came across that I thought were really great. This first one is another tidbit from Wellesley's article, and it's just a story about a saint named Saint Dunstan, who was an anchorite, and he was written about in a work by an 11th century monk named Osburn. Apparently, St. Dunstan would occupy himself with metalwork, especially. So he would do like work with gold while he was secluded in his cell. And at one point, it is told in this life of St. Dunstan that the devil appeared to him. And he's like, "Oh, I'm the devil. I'm going to get you." And Dunstan defended himself by tweaking the devil's nose with a pair of hot metal tongs that he had been using to do his metalworking with. So very good job, Dunstan.
Well, you know, that this also makes me wonder about like the getting into sort of the isolation tank area, and also sensory deprivation in general. Like, if you're pursuing this spiritual life within the cell of the anchorite, you know, perhaps it ultimately aids that, because you set yourself off from so much sensory information. You know, you're perhaps putting yourself in a position to have one-on-ones with the devil, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you're engaging in metalwork in there, because, I mean, hopefully he wasn't using any, you know, anything that produced a lot of smoke or fumes or anything, because that would... Surely these things were well-ventilated.
Surely. That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Well, I think it's something we don't often think about when we are engaging in sort of half thought out desires for enclosed spaces. We don't think about the fact, oh yeah, I need to be able to breathe in there. You know, I want to have at least some fresh oxygen finding me within this chamber.
Yeah. Or to allow the mercury fumes to escape. One last detail just that I thought was too good not to mention, because this was not from Wellesley's article. I just came across this in the British Library's collection summary for the Jan Kreenwies. And it was a note describing the text and summarizing it. And it's listing many of the rules that are prescribed for the life of an anchoress. So to quote from the summary here, "We learn that anchoresses were prohibited from eating meat, and that they were not allowed any accessories or items of clothing that were decorative rather than practical. Rings, brooches, patterned belts, and gloves were not allowed. They were also forbidden from keeping pets, except cats."
Oh, cat is all about that box life. So
yeah, tying back into the original episode here. I'm not sure what the religious significance of allowing a cat into the cell is, but I thought that was interesting, especially compared to the sometime medieval associations between cats and witchcraft.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There's probably more that could be said about that. I should also point out, though, Hannibal Lecter was not permitted to have a cat. I do not remember him having a cat.
Oh, that would have gone poorly.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Now, certainly living out the rest of your life in a box, that is the ultimate. That is, certainly we can't top that. But what I thought we might come back to the idea of, what about just living part of your life inside of a box? What if you only slept inside of a box? And of course, again, if we think about the fact that we do tend to sleep in cubicle or rectangular rooms. So yeah, we all kind of sleep in boxes. But how come we don't see much in the way of like actual sleeping boxes? How come I don't actually crawl into a box to sleep at night?
Good question. I'd try it.
Well, first of all, I'd like to remind everyone that if you listen to our episode, or perhaps it was episodes on the invention of the bed, Box-like beds actually go back quite a ways in history. In fact, the some of the earliest examples of furniture within a domestic environment, as opposed to a tomb, certainly includes a box-like bed. There's one from the Orkney Islands off the coast of Scotland from around 3100 to 2500 BCE, and it's essentially a stone. It's a stone bed box. It's like this. It's not unlike the box that might be placed on the floor that your cat would climb into, except this was a stone box that you would fill then with some hides and whatnot to make it comfy. But you're still sleeping in a box.
Yeah. So I think if I remember correctly, this would be sort of like imagining a stone bathtub that you would line with soft material like straw or hides or things like that, and you get in the bathtub and have the padding on the bottom.
Yeah, exactly. So, to a certain extent, the idea of sleeping in a box is, that's just part of human history. And while a lot of our modern beds get away from a kind of boxy environment, and they're often more of an elevated situation, there are some times during which different humans certainly slept in boxes, and box sleeping was the fad, because certainly Victorian curtain beds to a certain extent create a box that you sleep in. Mm-hmm. And a part of this reality comes down to just the desire to have a warm place to sleep. You want to contain your body heat in the same way that you would if you were just covered up with a bunch of blankets. But what if you also just use curtains to shut off the rest of the room?
Okay.
But then there's the next step, and that is the idea of the box bed. So these were a kind of wooden wardrobe that you slept inside of. They were often ornate with an opening on one side. Often this was a door. So this is like a wooden door that swung open or slid open. There are other versions of it that were more like they just had like a curtain. And then there are also versions of it that were like part of the wall that were more in line with the sort of sleeping environments you might see in a confined, like ship cabin sort of situation.
So you look in the cabinet where you keep the nice silver, and then you get jealous of the silver and say, I want to be the nice silver. I want to be in there while I rest.
Yeah, exactly. If you look these up, you can find a number of different examples of this. One website I was looking at, this was a website called The Vintage News, and there is an author by the name of Louise Flatley, who wrote about them in 2019, included a number of pictures. And this author stated that they probably started out in Brittany 600 years ago and subsequently spread throughout Europe. And yeah, it seems to have largely been something like the curtain bed, in that it was a good way to stay warm during cold nights. And it might have added security, either real security or sort of psychological security, for the protection of children during the night. So you want the children to be safe. Well, let's have them sleep in this box. Let's actually have a door on the box and we can just shut them up in there.
It's interesting how the thermal value of the box bed mirrors what we were talking about with cats, that, you surround yourself with an at least partially insulated material to trap in your body heat.
Yeah. Now, apparently a Scottish variant was popular in the 16th through 19th centuries. So if you look around, you can find examples of the Scottish box bed. And I have to say, these look quite comfy. These are not nearly as wardrobe-like as some of the other examples you'll find. These are more just bed spaces set into the wall with a curtain that may be drawn. And some of them look quite stylish, quite modern. And then you tend to have more traditional cabinets underneath them. And sometimes I think there's like a bench that folds out.
Yeah, they're kind of set into an alcove. It looks incredibly cozy to me. I want to get in one right now.
Yeah, they look cool. I would love to hear from anyone out there who sleeps in one of these. Maybe there are some problems. I don't know. Like, I guess if you're sleeping two to a bed, somebody's going to be stuck up against the wall there and can't get out. But if that person really likes to be cozy, that's probably the prime place to be, right? You're all the way in the back.
Right.
As long as you don't have to go to the bathroom during the night. But then also, I guess you have firm walls in place. So if you're too tall, you're just going to be bunched up in there. I don't know.
That is the thing, is looking at this picture you've attached. It looks very cozy, but it also looks relatively short.
Yeah. Now, this style apparently largely went out of style with the advent of 20th century heating. But I've also read that they may be making a comeback, that Carve Scandinavian bedboxes seem to have made a return in recent years. I wasn't really able to find much in the way of evidence of this. I'm not doubting it, but I'm mostly just finding some interesting designs on Pinterest boards and whatnot, and antique photos. So I'd love to hear from listeners on this as well. If you've been checking out, bed and breakfasts throughout Europe, or checking out real estate, are box beds making a comeback? Are you finding people sleeping in wardrobes?
Yeah. What are the Airbnb keywords for this?
Because on another level, it seems like you can get in trouble for sleeping in a box. Because here in the United States, there was the story of cartoonist Peter Berkowitz, who, in order to survive San Francisco's housing market, which has been insane for a while, moved into a wooden box in a friend's apartment, paying just $400 a month. And I've seen pictures of this box, so I guess it's more in line with kind of like an anchorite's cell, in that it's like this elongated wooden box. It has a bed in there and just, some room for some space. It's like this tiny compartment, except instead of being attached to a church, it's in your friend's living room. And so he ended up writing a piece about it for The Guardian and getting some press out of it, because I think a lot of it, too, is just like, hey, San Francisco housing market is insane. Look what I'm having to do to deal with it. And he ended up getting busted for it, because the idea was that these pods and boxes were said to violate local laws and create a fire hazard.
Well, maybe, but that kind of thing, I'd always kind of wonder also if it's just like the neighbors just don't like it.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to tell how much of that is, how much of it is neighbors, how much of it is politics, et cetera. He's making a stink about the housing market in the city. Et cetera. But I don't know. There you can also see that there could be some legitimate concerns about, say, ventilation. Especially if you make your own box to sleep and live in, are you providing enough ventilation for this? Is air getting in there? I think back to when we were recording together in a studio, mm-hmm. we were in a box within a room, but then mm-hmm. they had a separate air conditioning fan system set up to keep the air circulated through that little box that we were in.
Sometimes it worked.
Sometimes it worked. Yeah. And sometimes there had been five people in there ahead of us, and it clearly was not working that hard.
Oh, yeah. The days of 100% humidity inside the podcast studio. That was a time.
Now getting a little bit into this idea of box beds, but also coming back to the anchorites, I found a book by one Carrie Howie from 2007 titled Claustrophilia, The Erotics of Enclosure in Medieval Literature. And it for anyone who wants a really deep contemplative dive on this topic, I think this would probably be the book to check out, because the author points to a kind of dual horror fascination with confined spaces, not only during the Middle Ages, but also in, say, modern cinema. So they specifically bring up the 2002 David Fincher film Panic Room as an example of this.
Hmm. I never saw that one.
Oh, it's pretty good. It's where Jodie Foster uh-huh. plays this woman and her, and then she has a daughter, I think. And when the bandits come, led by Dwight Yoakam as the lead villainous bandit, and he's quite good in it.
Oh, weird.
He's kind of a creeper. So he plays the role well. So it becomes their place of shelter, but also kind of a prison. So it does get into this dual idea of the panic room as being the place of safety, but also the place that you're trapped.
Sorry, I'm still not getting over Dwight Yoakam.
Yeah, I mean, he's good in it. I don't know that I've seen Dwight Yoakam in many dramatic roles, but he's good in Panic Room. Anyway, Carrie Howie writes the following. Indeed, not only do fear and fascination go hand in hand when enclosures are at stake, fear is often alloyed with desire. Claustrophobia is, at bottom, in part a denied love of confinement. That is to say, it is always alloyed with claustrophilia. The Middle Ages had a particularly sensitive and sensory understanding of this. In the devotional text discussed below, it will become clear that enclosure was unavoidable for high medieval religious culture. It was not only secretly desired through repression, but openly courted, constructed, lived in.
So I haven't read it, but I would imagine Howie's book probably touches on some of the themes of the anchoritic life as well.
Yes, I believe so. Now, outside of the Western world and getting more into the modern world, I feel like we have to at least mention capsule or pod hotels in Japan. I've never stayed in one of these, but I think a lot of us have seen photos and photo galleries of such hotels. Maybe you've seen them pop up in a documentary. And they do fall into that category that I mentioned earlier, where it's like, it's kind of like a sci-fi pod, a stasis pod. And you can't help but look at it and think, oh, on some level, that's a desirable place to be.
Yeah, totally.
So these started in the late 70s, I believe, and they're notable for their low price, small space, and they're apparently ideal for business travelers as well as people who've, say, been out on the town and they've become intoxicated and they can't return home, across, say, the Tokyo sprawl, and therefore this is like a quick place you can go and bed down. But yeah, there's something undeniably attractive about them. I was looking at various photo galleries of them, and I'm seeing like mountainous regions as being popular. I guess if you don't have a lot of real estate and you potentially need like a high sleep density environment, it makes sense to have capsules or pods for people to sleep in.
You know, I've often wondered why they don't make airplanes where you can buy a horizontal sleeping pod instead of a seat. I would have to guess that it's just the geometry doesn't work out. Like, they can't fit as many into the plane that way as they can vertical seats. But I don't know. If you work in designing airplanes, why is that? Why are there not planes like that? I want to know.
Well, you do see things like this, I think, in first class accommodations for certain airlines with long flights. Mm-hmm. I've never experienced it myself, but I know they have things like that. You occasionally see photographs of it. And maybe we have listeners out there who can attest to it. But speaking of flights, I've also seen the capsule pod model at least argued as a solution for airports, where especially if you have solo travelers who have like a long layover, it may not make sense to actually leave the airport, check into a hotel, but you have that long layover, and what are your choices? To sleep awkwardly in one of the chairs out there while waiting, or to curl up in the corner and hope nobody messes with you? What if you could pour yourself into a nice comfy pod and just, be the goo for 6 hours?
Oh, totally. I would be the goo. I have slept on an airport floor. I didn't like it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not particularly desirable. I should also mention there is or was a capsule hotel in Pinghang, China, the Pinghang Space Capsule Hotel. And this one is also run by robots. So it's very sci-fi based on the photographs I've seen, where you have these capsule-like environments that you sleep in, but also there are zones where robots are bringing around, I think they're bringing around drinks. So
I smell the setup of a sci-fi horror movie. Nice bottle budget. Looks good.
Yeah. Capsule budget even.
Yeah.
I guess one more thing we should discuss here, and there's not a lot of hard information about this because these are mostly just designs. I don't think anyone actually has one of these. But at least back as far as 2015, various videos and animations depicting earthquake-proof beds were making the rounds. Do you remember these, Joe?
Maybe vaguely.
They were popular. You saw like Gizmodo articles about it. I saw an article on The Verge about it, and you even saw like Stephen Colbert and various like late night talk show hosts covering it because it's just so weirdly comforting, but also horrific to look at. I want to quote James Vincent's write up from The Verge. He nicely summarizes, quote, "Earthquakes, humanity's oldest foe, right up there with snakes, fire, and other humans when it comes to things that will definitely probably kill you someday. Which is why you need one of these terrifying earthquake-proof beds. In the event of a quake, your conspicuously massive four-poster will simply swallow you up whole, letting you get back to sleeping while the world itself shatters around you."
Oh man, I love that, especially because that's like blatantly false that earthquakes are one of humanity's oldest foes. Like, an earthquake is really not very dangerous at all until you are in a built city.
Right. Prior to the construction of cities and larger buildings, that's where the true danger enters the scenario. Now, this the one that that Vincent is specifically referring to here, I think, is one that had a really neat neat animation to guide it, where you had essentially a bed that has a trap door in it. So earthquake occurs, sets off the sensor, the bed does a trap door effect, and you and whoever is sleeping on the bed just fall into like a pit, and then it seals up behind you. And supposedly there's like water and supplies in there. And it's implied that you never wake up, that you just like you just wake up the next morning. Oh, I guess there was an earthquake in the night because now I'm in the comfortable darkness of my bed's belly.
Now I'm an anchorite for the next 17 days or until we run out of water.
Yeah. Now, there have been various versions of this. I think some of them have been kind of attributed to the same inventor. There's a Chinese inventor by the name of Wing Wing Zi called the Metro Farm bed that in its earlier stages just seems like a bed with high protective arms that doesn't look that weird at all and looks actually kind of nice. Mm-hmm. But then there are versions of their design that also involve moving doors, wings, etc. I've seen some variations of a so-called earthquake-proof bed that essentially looks like sleeping on top of a box, and then that box swallows you to protect you. I've also seen some where the bed itself doesn't drop you, but like big metal fingers come out from under the bed and cover you to protect you from earthquake debris.
I'm surprised that so many of these have these moving parts. It would seem to me, I mean, I'm no expert, but I would guess the best kind of earthquake proofing you could have on a bed would just be to give the bed a reinforced roof.
Yeah, yeah. It doesn't seem like you need the added complexity and potential danger of having doors that close and catch limbs that, you know, or requirements that you would need to maintain a particular sleeping posture in order to avoid being decapitated by your bed, that sort of thing.
But I want to be fair. Maybe there's stuff I'm not getting about this.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and ultimately, these are concepts, you know. Clearly, inventors are still feeling out the possibilities because, again, I come back to my own inner world. And on one level, yes, this looks terrifying. It looks reminiscent of the scene where Freddy Krueger reaches up through the bed and pulls somebody down into the bed.
Yeah. That's Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp, wasn't it?
And then the bed just like vomits 83,000 gallons of blood onto the ceiling.
Yeah, for like 15 minutes, it felt like. So on one level, yes, it feels like that. But on the other level, it's like, what if my bed could hug me? What if my bed could become my egg? And in that idea, especially in the wake of a potential threat like an earthquake, it does sound kind of nice.
Bed is goop.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close it out here. We're going to go ahead and press the panic button on our swallowing bed and seal ourselves off for this episode. But we'd love to hear from everyone out there. What are your feelings and thoughts on enclosed spaces for sleeping or living or otherwise? Have you stayed in a Japanese pod hotel or some of these examples in, say, Italy or Switzerland? Report back. What was it like? Was it great? Was it not so great? Was it a mix of the two? Did you feel comfortable? Did you feel like the goop? We'd love to know all about that. You know, these various beds, box beds, have you slept in one? Are they making a comeback? All of it's fair game.
Are you an anchorite? If so, let us know.
If so, what are you doing listening to podcasts? I feel like that should not be allowed. Unless you were a podcast anchorite, where your sole responsibility is to listen to as many podcasts as possible with your podcat, who's also there. In order to attain spiritual enlightenment.
Oh, also, I want to hear about people's experiments with their cats. I don't know if we mentioned this at the end of the last episode. Mm-hmm. Maybe we did. But yeah. If you've put out a square to see if your cat will sit on it, that kind of thing, yeah, feel free. Write us about it.
Yeah, I think there's already some action on that. We either received a listener mail or somebody shared it on the discussion module, which is the Facebook page where people who dig the show, you know, hang out and share links and whatnot.
I think so far we got one yay and one nay on Facebook. One person saying, yeah, put down the tape square, cat got right in it. Another person saying the cat doesn't even go anywhere near it.
Yeah, keep it coming. We need more data. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, we just ask that you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.